Take your Bibles and open to Ruth chapter 2. I said last week, and I mentioned again this morning, that we're going to talk about singles and how you go about getting married. Now, if you came here looking for like 10 easy points to a boyfriend or, you know, 5 easy steps to a girlfriend, you're going to be really disappointed. But if you'll listen, and not just singles, but all of us, we will learn some really important principles from this encounter that starts now in Ruth chapter 2. This is a chapter that should make us all smile. Chapter 1 is not a happy, smiling chapter, but chapter 2 is. But just so we get the context and we don't like start out gleefully, the reality is that Naomi and Ruth have arrived in Bethlehem. The famine is over. And we know their condition when they come. And they have very little to smile about as they arrive and as then we arrive in chapter 2. If you were to use some adjectives to try to describe these two women as we approach chapter 2, I think these come close. I would say they are, and I speak of both of them, they are widowed, they are destitute, they are poor, they are vulnerable, and they are eking out a fragile existence. That's what we can know about these two women. And by the time we get to the end of chapter 2, which will take us a few weeks, life will look completely different. Even though you might look and still say they're widowed, they're still poor, and they're still just kind of eking out a fragile existence, but they will have realized they're not as vulnerable as they thought they were, and they are not and never were destitute. All right, so let's learn this together. We're going to start with verse 2. Verse 2. So you're in Ruth somewhere there. Find chapter 2. Look with me at verse 2. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor." And she, Naomi, said to her, "Go, my daughter." Now, Ruth, just so you know, even though she's younger, considerably younger than Naomi, she is all the same things that I just said about them. I just want to reiterate, it can also just be said about Ruth. So now she begins to take center stage, and let me just put in front of you again a picture of Ruth. She's widowed. She is destitute. She is incredibly poor. In fact, she probably owns nothing more than the clothes on her back. She is in a very vulnerable position and eking out a fragile existence. But she has even more, we might say, against her than that. So her and Naomi would share that. You might say Ruth is advantaged by her age. Well, let me add, she's disadvantaged by the fact that being all of that, she's also an alien. She's an immigrant. She's a stranger in a foreign land. That's how Ruth 2, verse 2 begins. So I just wondered if it was Monday morning in Bethlehem and you were Ruth. Hard, I know, for most of you to imagine that. Some of you, it's pretty close to home when you think of losing a loved one, being a widow even. But imagine it's a Monday morning and this can be said of you. Widowed, destitute, poor, vulnerable, an immigrant, a stranger in a strange land. So how would you face your Monday? I mean, what's your attitude like? Maybe you thought, I'll just stay in bed. I mean, there's very little reason it seems to get up. It would be easier to just lay here. Maybe if somebody came by later in the afternoon, I'd get up and then I could tell them what a horrible day I'm having. Can you relate to that at all? I think we can. Even if those adjectives aren't our adjectives, you've got your adjectives. You've had those Monday mornings. Tomorrow may be one. I think I'll just lay here. I think that's the better option. But Ruth, in her circumstance, determines not to just lay there. Despite the fact that all of those adjectives we apply to her, they come with great risk. If she moves out into the community, she risks being ostracized to her face. She risks finding herself in a community that's not so crazy about foreigners, not at all pleased with the immigration policy. She runs the risk that, well, many of you can relate to, because culturally these things change a little, but the foundation's the same. She's a woman moving out into a man's world. It's Monday morning. Why not just stay in bed? Far less risky. She can't imagine she's going to go out and get a job. Nobody's going to hire her. Nobody in Bethlehem would hire a foreign woman to a task, a marketable task, that where she earned her own keep. Her only hope is that she might find some favor. And she gets that. That's what she says. That word favor, by the way, that's a translation of an Old Testament word that really means grace. She's looking for grace. She knows the only way she can face her Monday is if she's the benefactor of something she doesn't deserve. And we need to note that in that condition, I'm imagining a Monday, it's not that, but maybe a Monday, there's something we know for certain is on Ruth's mind besides, I just got to get up and go, I got to do something. She's concerned for her mother-in-law. Now we know this is her heart in chapter 1. I'm going wherever you go. I'm staying wherever you stay. Your God's going to be my God, and even after you die, I'll stay. But now it becomes very practical. And she understands that if I just lay here, I might have chosen to starve myself to death. But I have a mother-in-law, and I can't let that happen to her. So understand, as she's faced with this decision, she's going to make a decision to get up and get out. And a big part of that motivation is she's doing it for Naomi. Naomi needs to eat. They need to survive. So I would say this to young people, and there's some younger people in here. Friends, learn from Ruth. You have an obligation to your parents. You have an obligation, even in this case, to your in-laws. As life goes by and takes its toll, and the only toll that it has to take is the common toll of age, children, don't forget your parents. Don't. See, my kids are in here, and the ones that aren't in here, they can get a copy of the tape. Don't put me in one of those places. Take care of me. We don't have time to develop that. I just want to point that out. That's clearly a part of Ruth's motivation. It's her concern for her aging mother-in-law. Young people, you have a responsibility, according to Scripture, to honor your parents. It's not a tip of the hat. No, a tip of the hat now and then is not a bad thing. It's a commitment, no matter what happens. Woven in this room are 20-somethings and 80-somethings. And you've seen that. The older version of this room has seen that. They've had to make those decisions. How do I take care of my parents? How close, how responsible will I be? And there are good examples of that here, and surely some that aren't great examples of how we faced it. I'm just telling you, the biblical example is you have to do it with honor. Honor for your parents. So Ruth is thinking of all these things. But notice, she has a priority. The priority, she says there, I'm going to go to the field and I'm going to glean among the ears of grain. My priority that's moving me, all the motivations being there, but the one that's obvious is I've got to have some food. We're going to have to eat. And so she's moving out, but notice, moving out even in that pursuit in hopes of favor. I'm going out to glean among the ears of grain, and I hope that I find somebody out there who will grant me grace. Now, we know already that Ruth loves God. And we hear this language, and we can't separate that language from a gracious God. So we could say, I'm moving out, I'm taking this action, and perhaps she's already learned, we certainly have learned, but she's already learned from her dead husband and from the encouragement of Naomi, from the culture of this one true and living God, that He has promised to provide for His own. God will provide. The Bible says that. It says it in shouting terms to us as Christians in the New Testament. Philippians 4 says, God will supply to every need of yours according to His riches in glory in Christ Jesus. He has promised to meet your every need. It says in 2 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 8, He's able to make all this grace, all this favor abound to you, so that you can have sufficiency in all things at all times, so that you can then go out and be an abounding favor to others as you do your good work. But notice again, back in verse 2, back in Ruth chapter 2, verse 2, she's not being presumptuous here. She if she understands that, she's not saying, I'm going to go out and, by golly, God, you got to take care of me. You owe that to me. No, I'm going out understanding God has promised, but yet I'm not presuming on this. I am hoping I might find what? Favor, grace. I don't deserve it, but I'm hoping I might find it. And more than that, the respect here, she doesn't just go. She asks Naomi, can I go? Would you let me go so that we can have something to eat? Not, I need to go get a job, Naomi. I can't sit around here forever and take care of you. That's not what she said. Besides, as I already said, that's not going to happen. She's not going to go get a job. But she says, Naomi, for your good and my good, I've got to go see if we can find some favor. I need to seek out God's grace. And notice, though, I said God's favor. What did she say? I'm not going looking for the favor of God. I'm going looking for some man to give me favor. She's talking here about a landowner. I'm hoping that somewhere out there there's a him who will offer me grace. The him being the landowner who has all this grain. Are those two different things? If I say to you that Ruth's motivation was the promise that God would provide, and yet at the same time she said, I'm looking for the favor of God, yet we know she actually meant I'm looking for a man's favor. Are those different things, or are those different ways to say the same thing? Well, for believers in God, for Christians, there are different ways to say the same thing. Because we understand that God's favor doesn't come to us except through means. There's the ordinary means by which God extends His favor to us. And in this case, the ordinary means would be that she might find grace in the eyes of a landowner. Now, we struggle here. I had a little discussion on the patio just now. This understanding, we're making choices. Where's God in this? And now here I'm saying God is the one that grants favor, but yet she's looking for a man to grant some favor. And where will it come from? What's the height of her optimism? Do you see it? My optimistic view today, Naomi, as I go out here looking for grace, is that I might glean. Glean is the key word. Among all the ears of grain, that I might glean some for us. What she's optimistic about is, in fact, rooted in God's favor, because God has established for His people that that's exactly what they should do anytime there's someone who's poor and destitute. It's a part of the law. It's really written a lot of places, but here's a good place, Leviticus 19. Look what God said to landowners. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field right up to its edge. Leave some on the edges. Neither shall you gather the gleanings after your harvest. So now we know the gleanings is the stuff left over after the harvest. Don't gather those. Just leave them there. Don't strip your vineyard bare. Don't pick every grape. Neither shall you gather the fallen grapes of your vineyard. You send the guys out to get those big clusters of grapes. Some are going to drop. Leave them there. Don't pick them up. Leave them, look, for the poor and for the, let's use our word, for the immigrant. Strangers, sojourners. And I'm telling you to do this because I'm God. And as with all the law, this is a reflection of my character. This is a reflection of my compassion. Watch, this is how I will show favor to people like Ruth. This was His plan. That's fascinating, I think, for a minute, not to belabor this, God's plan for the poor. You could call this biblical welfare. And I would just submit to you, it's not anything like our welfare. He did not say, set this thing up where they can just go to the bank and get a food stamp debit card and stop into Walmart and get whatever they want. He didn't say that. You actually had to go to work and glean. Leave them something to glean. And gleaning is the hardest of all harvests. It's pretty easy to go out to a full harvest and pick some grapes. It's very difficult to spend hours in a vineyard that's already been picked over and hope you can find some grapes. But you understand the beauty of this plan, of God's plan? The poor and the destitute don't need a handout. They need to invest themselves with energy and diligent work, knowing that God will provide. This is the very first I will work for food program. Except they meant it. The guy on the corner doesn't mean it. I've tried. I've offered them jobs. They don't want to work. I shouldn't say they all don't. I've not met one yet who does. They want something for nothing. And I just want to submit to you that it's destroying those people. It's robbing them of one of the essential dignities that every human gains even after the fall, and it's the dignity of work. She's going to have to work, not a job. She's not going to get hired, but she's going to have to work if her and Naomi are going to eat. Now, somebody by now might be saying, well, if Ruth was a little more spiritual, she'd just stay in bed and ask God to feed her. That's just silly, right? I hope y'all know that. And you can watch that stuff on television. It's silly. That's not how God grants favor. This is just common sense in large measure, and while I realize there's not a large measure of common sense around anymore, it doesn't take a genius to figure this out. Here's what Ruth knows, just basic common sense. I'm ready to do what I can do, and I'm willing to leave in the hands of God what only He can do. That's how we function as Christians. That's how she's determined to act. Now, because I think we lack in this area, I want to take just a minute here. I won't go too far, but I want to take just a minute to show you very practically how that principle is reiterated. So you might turn to Philippians 2. You don't have to. I printed it here, and I want to do this quickly. But here's Philippians 2, verse 12, instruction to you and me as believers. Therefore, my beloved, as you've always obeyed, so now, not only as in my presence, but much more in your absence, look what he says. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Now, the Apostle Paul is a theological expert. And this is precise, though it may rattle some of your theology. But the precision is, this is how it works. I'm a Christian, and he's writing to Christians, and I want you to know you've got to invest and work out this salvation, right? Knowing, look at the next verse, knowing that God is working it in. God is working in you so that, watch, both His will and His good pleasure will flow through you. I just want you to understand that you can't stay in bed. That's not the Christian thing to do. You've got to go out there and you've got to invest yourself with energy, knowing that that's how I find favor in the eyes of God. I don't just lay here and wait for the ceiling to open up and drop stuff down. So moms and dads, I can't chase all this, but moms and dads, don't do that. Don't just drop stuff in your kids' laps, right? Give them a little, make them invest a little bit of effort in this thing. Now watch this, what Paul says. You say, okay, I'll do that. I'll do it. All right, I'll do it. Well, he says, wait, don't do it that way. Do it without grumbling. Do it without disputing. Because to do it, watch, to do it, you got to go out there and do it. When he talks about working out salvation, there's an aspect of that where he imagines, I mean, get up and get out there among them. That's where we work it out. We don't work it out in here, work it out there. Watch what he says. So that by not grumbling or complaining about the fact that you have to actually have to be invested in this, you'll be blameless and innocent. You'll be children of God without blemish. Where? In the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, among whom you will then shine as lights in the world. Christian, do you know where we shine? We shine out there. There's enough light in here that if you turn your little light on, it kind of gets lost. Praise God for that kind of light. But you put your light on out there, it'll get noticed. So how do you shine your light? How do you make a difference in a crooked and twisted generation? Get out there, work, and work it out. And do it without complaining. Now stay with me because I'm really not off track. This is Paul following what Jesus said when Jesus said, you're the light of the world. You can't just be a lamp. You got to be set up on a hill. You can't cover that thing up. You can't put it on a basket. You got to light with it. You got to reach out with this reality. In the same way, verse 16, you have to light, let that light shine before others who will see your good works and bring glory to God. So Ruth is doing what every Christian must do, what the Apostle Paul says we must do, what Jesus says we must do. If you want to make a difference, and I hope you do, this is how you do it. You get out there among these crooked, twisted, pagan people, and you shine a light without grumbling or complaining while you energetically invest yourself as a recipient of God's great favor. That's how you do it. It's not rocket science. Get out there. Now, for some of you, it's not get out there and go to work. It might be get out there and go to school or get out there and play baseball on the baseball team. But however you get out there, get out there. Don't sit at home on your knees and expect God just to pour favor out on you. Not going to happen. Now, while you're out there, you need to know it's dangerous out there, right? It's dangerous out there. A lot of you don't go out there for that reason. I ain't going out there. I'm not going to send my kids out there. I'm going to homeschool. I'm going to home cook. I'm going to home grow. And there's maybe benefits to all that, but one of the things that's not a benefit is to keep you from being out there. That's not Christian. That's monasticism proving itself to fail. All right, but now I'm out there, but I'm telling you, it's dangerous out there. It's dangerous, so Paul says, he's not finished, so that you can be blameless and innocent, look at verse 16, while you hold fast to the word of life. I'm going to be doctrinally sound in my conviction so the world, when I get out there amongst all those crooked, twisted people, doesn't have a negative effect on me. So that in the day of Christ, I can be proud that I didn't what? I didn't run in vain or labor in vain, and I certainly didn't stay at home. Well, what if it doesn't go well? I mean, we don't have to imagine hard. This may not go well, Paul. Are you sure? Well, he's still not finished. Even if it doesn't go well, even if I'm poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrificial offering of your faith, I am glad and I rejoice with you all. And likewise, you should be glad and rejoice with me that even though you get out there amongst them and you work out this salvation with fear and trembling, and you don't imagine that favor just comes to those who stand here like this and say, you know, God, I'm waiting, and it still doesn't go well, you'll still rejoice. And by now, some of you in here are single and you're thinking, what does this got to do with being single? It has everything to do with being single, because you're a Christian first before you're single. And you better not decide to pursue marriage while you park for a little bit your pursuit of Christianity. If you're going to find God's mate for you as a Christian, then you need to start acting like a Christian. So I don't know where to start. I was like, 1-800, find my match? Well, maybe. But the Bible would say, get out there amongst them. Get out there. Get out there. Hold fast. Get out there. Now, undergirding all this, back in Ruth, God doesn't want the poor to suffer. But He also doesn't want us to make them worse off by treating them like a project. Don't strip them of their dignity. And young people, I've taught you already, reminded you, take care of your parents. So all these principles are here. But we're looking now at a single woman about to do what? Get out there amongst them. So back in Ruth, chapter 2, verse 2, Ruth said, I'm going to go out here and glean, and I'm just hoping I might meet somebody. Now, there's no indication here she's looking for a husband. Which, by the way, singles, you might want to write down. The best way to find one, stop looking for one. But I won't press that too hard. But here, she's not looking for a husband. But she does realize that if there's any hope for her, she's going to need a man to grant her favor. You see, behind the gleaning for sustenance in Ruth's life, it'll become evident by the end of the chapter, is she has a desire to be married. So take this with me, single Christian. I have a desire to be married. And what you tend to do is say, now, what should I do first in that regard? Who do I call? What small group do I join? What bar can I go to and not like be in the scuzzy part? But you know what can I do? And I just submit to you, you started wrong. All of it's wrong. Start here. I'm a Christian and I desire to be married. What I need to do is the next thing that God commands me to do. And I need to be sure that I respect my elders around me and that I go to work so that I can meet the daily needs that I have and that my mother... She's just doing what's right in front of her. She's not pursuing some kind of a plan and a path that produces on the other end a marriage. I've stood in my 20 plus years of ministry now, I've stood in front of couples say I do who months later wish they had said I don't. But they ended up where they were going all along. It was kind of the fruit of the pursuit. So be careful here. Much more about this in the coming weeks. But I just want you to see behind this is a pursuit of marriage, but it's not evident because that's not really what's moving Ruth. She's doing the basic things. So I would say to you this, in case I've been confusing. Singles, tomorrow, start your day Ruth's way by doing whatever your responsible task is. Whatever that is in your life, according to God's will and His providence in your life, do it. Go about your day. Do what needs to be done. Respect your responsibilities and all the while anticipate the very present promise that God might grant you favor. Watch. In some of the most amazing ways you ever imagined. And by bringing into your path people you never dreamed you'd meet. And you've read ahead, she's going to meet a man she never didn't even know he existed. Because once they find out who he is and that he's family, I mean, you would think it pursuit of marriage, Naomi would have long ago pulled out the list of available men. I mean, here's the available man, and he would have been on the list. They hadn't done any of that. Had no expectation of meeting this guy. So I want to say it again. Singles, go about your day. Do what needs to be done. Respect your responsibilities and all the while anticipate the very present promise of God's favor coming to you from surprising people in surprising places. Did you get all that down? You can listen to it later. That's what Ruth did. That's what she did. Verse 3. It says, so she set out. Can I go? Yes, you can go. I'm going to go. Can I go? Yes, you can go. Okay, I'm going to go. Can I go? Yes, you can go. Okay, I'm going to go. Why did I repeat that? Because some of you stuck right there. I'm going to. I am. I'm going to. Well, that's not what she didn't say. I'm going to. She went. She actually did it. She actually went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. I love these next words. In any translation, I love these next words. And she happened to come. She just happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz. Just happened. And he was of the clan of Elimelech. And we know his name. We met him. That's part of her family now. The King James Version says it this way. Now, you got this one. Look up there. Or look up here. You can see. And she happened to come. Here's the King James Version. And her hap was to light. That's helpful. It was her happening to light in this place. She just happened to land there. The NIV says it this way. As it turned out, no matter what translation you read, I just want you to see what's very obvious here. We are meant to see this and to understand how Ruth viewed all this. It seemed almost happenstance. You can't plan this. It just happened. Now, again, we have the benefit of the rest of the story. What we know just happened, if we use theological language, is she's about to be trained in the school of God's providence, and she's about to experience a remarkable providence of God. But what does it look like in your life? You know, you hear that and you say, well, Pastor Steve, I've never heard that remarkable providence. Yeah, it happens all the time. What does it look like? Well, it just looks like you just happen to be somewhere. That's how we interpret remarkable providences. It's not clouds and smoke and lightning and an angel with wings. It's just ordinary. It just happened. And so that's how Ruth is interpreting this. She says, it just happened to be there. I went out with a purpose to glean, and I needed to find favor with some harvester who would allow me to glean their fields. God had gone before me and established a law that had been passed down now for generations to other Jewish landowners and harvesters. God had worked before me, and I went out, and I just happened to be here, and it just happened to be a field that belonged to Boaz. And I'm just telling you, that's a remarkable providence. And furthermore, I will tell you, Christian singles, your life is no less in His hands. No less. This isn't something peculiar for Ruth. This is God. This is how your God works in your life, in your circumstance. He is way ahead of you. And you got to move out there expecting and anticipating, but not that you can come back next Sunday and say, the most remarkable thing happened to me. That will rarely be your testimony. Your testimony will be, I just happened by. She hasn't even realized yet, and won't till late in the chapter, there's any remarkableness to it. So we need to think for just a minute, singles, but all of us as Christians, about this idea of God's providence. We do this pretty regularly because it's so important. It's how we experience God in our lives. Providence, I would say this to you first, is a pillow upon which we can put our heads every night. You can rest there. But more than that, I don't think it's ever been said better than it's said in the Westminster Confession of Faith. Of providence. So it's here. You can follow along while I read. God, the great creator of all things, does uphold, direct, dispose, and govern all creatures, actions, and things, from the greatest even to the least, by His most wise and holy providence, according to His infallible knowledge and the free and immutable counsel of His own will, to the praise of the glory of His wisdom, power, justice, goodness, and mercy. That's our God. This is what He is disposed to do, is to work according to His will all things that affect what? Creatures, actions, greatest to the least. We call that providence. He's always moving and working, but watch, never to the degree that we would say that's determinism. No, that's not what we mean. We mean He's moving and working all things according to His will, even though in the middle of all of this, you're working. And might say in accord with your own will. Who decided to glean? Ruth did. Who decided to let her go glean? Naomi did. Who decided to let her glean in this field? The harvester did. Who inevitably will honor that decision and then beyond that develop a relationship? Boaz will. And they are all absolutely free to make those decisions, but never freed from God's order and providence, even as He has decreed all things before time itself. That's what we mean by God's providence, and by for every single person here, your life is in His hands. Now, the divines that wrote this went on to help us. Although, in relation to the foreknowledge and decree of God, He knows everything and determines all things. He is the first cause. He's the first cause. Now watch. All things come to pass immutably and infallibly, absolutely, without change, and perfectly according to His will. Yet, by the same providence, He orders them to fall out according to the nature of second causes, either necessarily, freely, or contingently. Well, that's a lot of words, but they're worth your time. Here's the idea. Even though God knows all things, orders all things, brings all things, cannot be changed, cannot be altered, and it will always be perfect in accord with His will, there are secondary causes that are happening all the time that will happen and function according to the free will of His creatures. And those are two tracks that if you try to bring them together, you'll have a headache. They will collide in your reasoning. And so I would just submit to you, just leave them right there where God leaves them. He leaves them right there in His Bible. So we're free creatures making decisions like Ruth, like Naomi, like the harvester, like Boaz, yet never outside of God's direct providential care, determination, and that all things will happen exactly, perfectly, without change, according to His providence. Ruth is about to benefit from what? God's orders falling out through secondary causes. That's it. She's going to benefit from God's orders falling out through secondary causes. Boaz. And it will be what's best for her. And though she doesn't know it yet, what's best for her is that God would send her a husband. Now that's what's going to happen. And this is how it's going to happen. And then here's another point, and they go on. But as the providence of God does in general reach to all creatures, understand that after a special manner, God's providence takes care of His church. It takes care of His own and disposes all things to the good thereof. Now, if you read what's in between, you will read that God's providence extends to wicked people too and evil people, but it doesn't produce the same result. But for His church, it'll always produce the same result. What is best for them? What is best for them? So in other words, what we're reading in Ruth chapter 2 is God in His providence taking care of Ruth and Naomi through secondary causes. What was their present circumstance again? What was it? Widowed. Destitute. Poor. Vulnerable. Eking out a fragile existence. All of that's true. We can't change the circumstances. But this is also true. Romans 8:28 is also true. That God is working all of those things out in their lives for their good and in accord with His purpose, which He planned before time began. I hope your God's that big. And singles, if your God's not that big, good luck finding a husband. It's not going to work out well for you. When I counsel young couples, and some of them are here, in advance of or in consideration of their marriage, I like to give them resources. And, you know, there's 1,000 books out there. I'm not sure they're all great. And some are surely better than others. You know what book is required reading in almost every case of couples I counsel? A.W. Pink's The Sovereignty of God. Because I'm telling you, Christians, if you don't put that thing to bed and try to put your hand and head around and heart around the reality of a providential, sovereign and always good God, you will never consistently make good choices. And right now, before you go to that altar, is not one you want to mess up. This is so essential to live in the Christian life. We embrace sovereign providence. And at the same time, listen, we embrace real people making real decisions on their own. And we do not see those in contradiction. Ruth made a decision to do something. And she did it. Naomi made a decision to let her do it, and she did it. Workers in the field are going to get involved. We're going to have workers in the field that have to decide, you know, let some grapes lie, let some, right? There's so many countless things going on that have to work out in order for them to have a meal tonight. Do you think those same things aren't working on in your life all the time? What brought you here this morning? You say, well, my Toyota did. Just think about that for a minute. Your Dodge Challenger or your Ford pickup truck. Can you even conceive for just a moment, just let your mind think, all of the contingents, secondary causal factors that produced that vehicle so that you would confidently get in it and make your trip here? Or do you think you just wrote a check and it all happened? Or you make a payment every month and it just all happens? It doesn't just all happen. It's amazing. Well, we have to hurry. I'm almost out of time. So let's go to verse 3. So she set out and went, gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to this part of the field belonging to Boaz, and he just happened to be a family member. Now, we're going to learn next week this principle of what that means, this idea of a kinsman redeemer, and that's what she's meeting. She doesn't know that yet. But I want us to meet Boaz. Because here's the idea. She's out here in the field. The worker said, yeah, go ahead. You know, somewhere back there, God said this is okay. So you go ahead and do that. And the head harvester said, yeah, it's fine. You can work here. And now the boss shows up. Right? Boaz is the boss. He shows up. What's that going to be like? Right? What about tomorrow? Right? Everything would be great at work if the boss just stayed home. That's how we think. But then the boss showed up and it all went downhill. Well, let's meet the boss. The boss's name is Boaz. We know what family he was from. And really, we should have already met him, but your pastor skipped the first verse. He's really introduced to us in the first verse. Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. So let's just build a quick biography. We've got to do this fast. What do we know about Boaz? Look up here. What do we know? Number one, he's a worthy man. It can be interpreted a man of standing. The King James Version says he was a mighty man of wealth. Now all the single girls, I've got all your attention now. This is how it works out. No, not always. But this is how it's going to work out for Ruth. A single man of mighty wealth from the clan of Elimelech. Now we know we got some work to do because that's like an immediate disqualifier, right? What? He's like related to me? So hold on to that. We'll work that out next week, maybe. And more than that, he's gracious. He's gracious. I want you to see how gracious he was. It's actually in the next verse. And behold, the boss shows up from Bethlehem, and he says to the reapers, what are you guys doing? Straighten up. How many times do I have to tell you? I mean, I can barely get on the parking lot. I don't even have to come in the office. I know what's waiting. I mean, that's kind of the language of the boss, right? Should have fired you last week. Would save us both a lot of trouble. How many days you've been working here, by the way, not counting today? That's boss language. There's some Christian bosses in here. Sometimes that's your language. Shame on us. Look what Boaz, look how he starts his day. The Lord be with you. And all of them answered, the Lord bless you. Those are really derivatives of the same thing. And we don't really talk that way. Why not? You want to know what he actually said, what they actually said to one another when the boss showed up? If you kind of take the real meaning of the Hebrew, this is a good English translation, but it's deeper than that. Here's what they said to each other. May God's favor satisfy your souls. How you greet one another is so important. And this is how they did it. May God's favor, may His grace fully satisfy you. Now, we've got work to do. So what's next? What's next? What's next? But they paused to say this to each other. You know, I said this in my notes. You can tell a lot about a person by his hellos and his goodbyes. Young people, teenagers, millennials, you say, good morning. And they say, oh, morning. Not all of them. How's your day? But sometimes all you get is a grunt. May God's grace satisfy your soul. That's my wish for you. That's how they greeted each other. How do you greet each other? Bosses, gave you a new way to start your day. And employees, give you a new way to answer back to your boss. And now, it's about to get really interesting. Because Ruth's going to meet her future husband.